Cuba will get off a list, Senator Rubio puts his name on a list, and Florida lawmakers still have not solved the big issue on their to-do list. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. We'll discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making the headlines. President Obama wants to take Cuba off the list of state sponsors of terrorism. He made the announcement just days after a historic meeting with Raul Castro. Senator Marco Rubio calls for a new American century. He makes it official. He's running for the Republican nomination for the President of the United States. And Florida legislators remain deadlocked over health care spending, with the state budget hanging in the balance. It's all ahead, with your input, on the Florida Roundup next on WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. So another week of historic happenings in the quickly evolving American effort to restore relations with Cuba. First, the leaders of the two countries met for the first time since 1956. President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro sat down together at the Summit of the Americas in Panama. Just days later, President Obama announced he wants to remove Cuba from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. The decision would leave three countries on that list: Iran, Sudan, and Syria. Now, before he made that decision public back in the U.S., President Obama was at that summit in Panama, urging both sides to look forward, not backward.
I think we are now in a position to move on a path towards the future and leave behind some of the circumstances of the past that have made it so difficult, I think, for our countries to communicate.
We are willing to discuss every issue, but our countries have a long and complicated history.
Cuban leader Raul Castro there at the summit. Castro went on to apologize to President Obama, saying he does not blame the president for the U.S. trade embargo. Do you support Cuba's removal from the list of state sponsors of terrorism? Is Cuba a national security risk for America? What does the United States possibly get in return for dropping Cuba from the list as the negotiations to restore diplomatic relations continue? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup. Your input always welcome on the telephone at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, online on Twitter at WLRN, go onto the website at WLRN.org, or on Facebook, look for WLRN. All ways to communicate here with the Florida Roundup. Calvin Hughes is an anchor at Local 10 here in South Florida. Welcome, Calvin. Nice to see you here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
David Adams is the Southeast Bureau Chief for Reuters. David, welcome as well to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Tim Padgett, back from Panama, WLRN's America's editor with us here in Miami. Tim, is Cuba's removal from this State Department's list a done deal?
I think so. I mean, there are some things that Congress can do if they're unhappy with the decision to try to reverse it, but it's a costly process, and I don't think it's one that you're going to see Congress go into, largely because, as most diplomats will tell you, it's just not a diplomatic, a domestic political issue in this country that they're going to want to sink their teeth into.
David, this designation of a state sponsor of terrorism dates back to 1982. What does this removal allow between the United States and Cuba?
It removes some of the obstacles that exist currently, some of the sanctions that exist in the Treasury Department that govern commerce between Cuba and the United States. It doesn't mean that the embargo goes away, far from it. Many restrictions, many sanctions will remain in place, but it does ease some of them, and it will make it easier for American banking institutions, for American corporations to visit Cuba and explore future possible trade deals with Cuba.
And it also makes it easier for Cubans to bank in the United States, does it not?
In theory, it should. The Cuban government, the Cuban embassy in Washington currently has a problem. It doesn't have a bank that's willing to take its money.
An American bank, right.
Yeah. And part of that reason is because of the compliance issues that banks have to go through in order to handle money from countries that are on the terrorism list. So I think we'll probably see that issue resolved pretty quickly.
A week ago, Calvin Hughes, you were in Panama, and the talk around the summit and the conference was this kind of decision was coming. Many people expected it to happen at the conference. It didn't happen at the summit itself. Tell us what the conference was like for you and covering this historic meeting between Castro and Obama.
It was very busy, from sunup to sundown, quite busy, always something going on. I think the greatest sideshow at the summit was Nicolas Maduro and his sending out a body double.
The president of Venezuela.
The president of Venezuela. That was the fun part, but covering the meeting itself, the conference itself, was incredibly grueling for a lot of reporters because Panama is extremely humid, so you're spending a lot of time outside, so you're drained and soaking wet in your suit by the time you get inside the conference. But it was exhilarating. It was obviously a history-making moment, and a conference that I think, you know, a lot of people thought it was, you know, going to live up to his expectations, and on every account, I can say, you know, it did.
We spoke with the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, the host, essentially, of this conference, Tim, and he pointed out to us there were two results. One was expected, which was to have Cuba present, along with the United States for the first time over the seven summits that have been held since the early 90s when this organization got together. The second he called unexpected, which was the actual meeting between Castro and Obama, the first time sitting leaders from these countries have met since 1956.
Since 1956, and I plus the handshake, that was what we were all there for,
sure.
I think, was to see that historic handshake. But I think it was, you know, the meeting itself, I think, was even more significant because it projected this image of normalcy for once, which we haven't seen between Cuba and the United States for more than 50 years. And that's exactly what I think Obama wanted out of this summit, and because for two reasons. One, it neutralized, I think, a lot of his critics here who think that this new policy of engagement with Cuba is a big mistake, that the United States is giving up too many concessions, et cetera, we're not getting enough in return from Cuba. It also neutralized, as Calvin was pointing out, Nicolas Maduro's agenda, which was to turn this gathering into another Yankee go home fest, which it didn't, because of all the applause surrounding this historic meeting between Obama and Castro.
And whom he met with, by the way, for 10 minutes right before he got on Air Force One. Mm-hmm. It did not get the same kind of notoriety like his meeting, obviously, with Castro. I think what's interesting, too, with the Castro meeting is that we only focused on the chairs that were sitting in an Oval Office-style way as Castro and Obama sat across from each other, and then the handshake. But if you zoom out on that picture, if you look further, you saw Susan Rice. She was there. Mm-hmm. Roberta Jacobson, the point person for the talk, she was there. And all of their Cuban counterparts were there as well. This was a real heads of state meeting that Obama, talking about normalizing, he really did want to send a message back to Washington and say, hey, look, you know, we are actually trying to normalize relations.
We had the foreign minister of Cuba meeting with Secretary Kerry prior to the summit in Panama. We had the foreign minister of Cuba holding a news conference after this summit, David Adams with Reuters. I mean, there were a number of historic storylines that we saw play out in Central America this week.
Yeah, and that was the idea. The Obama administration wanted to make a big splash in
did
Panama.
It? Sounds like it did.
And I think they did. Obviously, you know, just like the big splash with Iran, some of the details haven't quite yet been nailed down. There is momentum on Cuba, and I imagine we will see probably pretty soon an agreement for the renewal of diplomatic relations after 54 years, swiftly, a U.S. embassy in Havana and a Cuban embassy in Washington.
Well, let us know your thoughts. Do you support this momentum toward this restoration of relations? This is the Florida Roundup. You can join the conversation at 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN, online on Twitter at WLRN, on Facebook, and on the website WLRN.org. I'm Tom Hudson. David Adams, you just heard from Reuters, Calvin Hughes from Local 10 along with us, and our America's editor at WLRN, Tim Padgett, also with us here on the Florida Roundup. David, you wrote a really interesting article over the past week or so detailing the president's connection to Miami and how perhaps his thinking regarding Cuba began to take shape even as he was a U.S. senator, a junior U.S. senator from the state of Illinois. How has Miami and the connections that the president has here influenced perhaps his strategy with re-engagement in Cuba?
Well, it's funny. It's something that I think was overlooked in the course of these negotiations, this Miami role. I was not aware myself until January that these meetings had taken place as far back as 2004. Part of the reason for that is that the meetings involved the city, the mayor of the city of Miami, Manny Diaz, and the city manager, Joe Arriola. It was Joe, in fact, who first met Obama in Chicago at a fundraiser for his Senate campaign. In 2004.
Over a smoke break as the two were trying to quit tobacco.
The pair of them were trying to give up cigarettes, and you know what that kind of what that can lead to sort of in bonding terms. You step outside, you bump into a guy who's got the same problem, and all of a sudden Joe Arriola starts bending Obama's ear about Cuba, and he'd never heard that message before, especially because Joe's message was, if Democrats want to succeed in South Florida, they need to stop listening to the far right.
And considering the time here, 2004, President Obama back then was a state legislator with experience in Springfield, Illinois, representing a district on the south side of Chicago, not in South Florida.
Right. There is a large Hispanic community in Chicago, and he had actually come into contact.
But not a large Cuban population.
No, but he had actually come into contact with academics at universities in Chicago who were familiar with the Cuba question, including actually a Cuban-American woman. But he'd never really looked at the issue from a political perspective in terms of, you know, where are the votes in South Florida.
Yeah.
And Joe Arriola's message was, look, there's a silent majority of us out there who are not being heard. We don't feel represented by our members of Congress. We are not pro-Castro, not by a long stretch, but we do believe that the policy has failed, the embargo, that is, and engagement with Cuba is worth trying.
And 10 years later, here we go, the announcement made in the middle of December 2014, and the path toward restoration of relations is off and running.
Well, Arriola and his friends didn't give up. Carlos Sala Rodriguez, the Cuba Study Group, a number of other people here in Miami, the Young Roots of Hope, came in a little bit later, and Obama, they were very, very persistent with their contacts with the White House, and the White House listened to them, and it helped shape the White House's eventual decision to go into those secret negotiations.
1-800-743-9576 is our phone number here on the Florida Roundup. 1-800-743-9576. Steve is joining us from Plantation. Steve, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I wanted to sit back and just comment a little bit on the normalizations of relations with Cuba, because sitting back and thinking about it, I'm wondering how many Americans outside of a few square miles in South Florida really care about the normalization of relations with Cuba when there are so many countries around the world, both communist, totalitarian, Middle Eastern countries whose human rights violations outnumber those of Cuba 10-1, but yet we have relations with those countries, both economically, financially, and through political means. And so who really cares if we don't have relations with Cuba? It's a country 90 miles away. It's a beautiful country. People used to vacation there all the time, and why not have relations with them?
Steve, we got the question. We hear that comment somewhat frequently, Tim, about, you know, the U.S. has close economic ties with China, for instance,
right,
a country that's human rights abuses are well documented and mostly well known.
Steve's point is an excellent one, especially because we are hearing more and more, why aren't the congressmen and senators like Marco Rubio and Ileana Ross Leitinen, who are so critical of Cuba, and rightly so, why aren't they as critical, for example, of China? China this week sentenced one of its independent journalists to 7 years in jail. And yet we're really not hearing a peep
right
out of Capitol Hill about this, particularly from Senator Rubio and congresspeople like Ileana Ross Leitinen. So I think that's one of the things that's undermining the more hardline exile position these days on Cuba.
Yeah, Calvin Hughes, you know, on the sidelines in the Panamanian summit, we did see some conflicts between Cuban supporters and opposition groups as well. We didn't see any of that really get into the summit itself.
Well, we didn't see that because I think for the first time, Panamanian's president allowed dissidents to be a part of the Summit of the Americas. In its 20-year history, that has never happened. So I think this time, because dissidents were allowed to be there, some governments thought it appropriate to have dissidents flown in from their country. Mm-hmm. And so the argument from Miami exiles is that Cuba's government flew in hundreds of dissidents to make it look as if they were independent of the government and then speaking out, but they were not. What happened, I think, on the very first day when we arrived on Wednesday, a couple of days before the summit began, we saw some video of a fight that took place. We later found out from Lincoln Diaz-Pillard and some others, Orlando Gutierrez, some others here in Miami, is that they were going there to lay flowers in front of the Jose Marti statue, which was given to Panama before Cuba's revolution. And so, and when they were doing that, about 10 agents ran out from the U.S. embassy and, quote, attacked those guys.
You mean from the Cuban embassy?
Yes. From the Cuban embassy. They ran out and attacked those people who were laying flowers in front of the statue, and then that's when the fight broke out. And it was a pretty brutal fight. I mean, people were dragged out of a van.
Tim, you spoke with some of those folks that were flown in from Cuba supporting the communist position, and really the next generation of communists in Cuba. This is the generation that presumably the Obama administration is targeting with this reengagement and with some of the policy choices. You spoke with one, Sergio Gomez, and his take on normalizing relations and what it means after decades of this conflict between the U.S. and Cuba.
You have been bullying us for the half century, and that's not a normal situation.
He's the international news editor for Cuba's official communist newspaper. So, you know, it really gets to how fast this evolution of relations is playing in Cuba.
Right. Well, I sought these young Cuban communists out at the summit because one of the big things President Obama keeps saying about this new engagement policy is that it's not meant to change Cuba overnight. It's meant to help the U.S. get in a better position to influence democratic change in Cuba once Castro and his generation of hardline communists is gone. But that begs the question, what about the next generation of communists? Because that's really, they're the people who this new policy of engagement is going to depend on. And on the one hand, what I heard from them was the party line, of course. I didn't expect them to stray from the party line, but I was listening for any hints that they might be more open to the kind of reform in Cuba that the Obama administration in the U.S. wants out of this new policy. But I think on the other hand, this new generation of communist leaders is going to have to deal with a particularly young Cuban population that is far more admiring of the United States, far more interested in, you know, democratic and particularly economic change.
Yeah, and to that point, David Adams with Reuters, what about the role of commerce at the Summit of the Americas? We heard from heads of state, political leaders, but I can imagine that commerce leaders were there. Corporate leaders certainly were sponsors on the side, whispering and trying to pick up on any whispers as this normalization continues.
Well, it's one of the aspects that some of the listeners might be intrigued to learn. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce made a big splash in Panama, and it has been arguing strenuously for lifting the U.S. embargo for many years. There was a CEO's summit in Panama, to which the Cubans were invited and participated. There were plenty of American CEOs, corporate leaders, and a lot of lawyers down there in Panama touting for business because Cuba is a country of 11 million people. It's the largest island in the Caribbean. It sits only 90 miles off U.S. shores. It is a virgin market for U.S. goods.
For U.S. goods, but Calvin, the knock against that is Cuba trades with 189 other countries in the world. What do us Americans think that we're going to make any big difference if in fact relations are normalized and the future of the embargo is questioned?
I also think what was interesting about that too is Obama, and this is to your point, Tim, is Obama loves to point to polls inside of Cuba that say they are all for this. There's no doubt that there are a lot of Cubans who are thinking, if I'm making 15, 20 bucks a month, that my life is going to change. There are some doctors who are making 15, 20 bucks a month over there and are driving cabs to supplement their income. So there is a feeling that life is going to change on the island as a result of this normalizing of relations. But, you know, the jury is still out on that. I also think that Obama thinks by allowing better internet connectivity in Cuba as well, that one day we're going to see 15, maybe 20 years from now, and I'm sure Obama's hoping sooner, that we're going to see some sort of a Cuban Spring happen over there as a result of Twitter. But I will tell you, to get on the internet there for 1 hour, it's $5 or $10. And if you're making $20 a month, the last thing you're thinking about, am I going to eat? Am I going to pay my rent? Or am I going to get on the internet to check my messages on Facebook?
5% internet penetration on the island of Cuba. We saw a Ben Dixon, Amandi poll come out of Cubans showing that President Obama's popularity rivals that of the Catholic Church and is twice that of the Castro brothers. The Communist popularity, the Communist Party popularity is roughly equal to the opposition party's popularity as well, to really show a battle for the political heart. Let's go back to the phones here to Delray Beach, and Warren joins us on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Warren.
Thank you for allowing me to participate. I think it's a good thing when people, when let alone nations, decide to communicate with one another. I think it ultimately leads to better things. Much better than trying to force people to give in through things like sanctions. I am very perturbed by Marco Rubio and or his colleagues. I think he's behaving as a spoiled brat, needs to be taken out to the woodshed and left there, and that, again, well, I like what Steve from Plantation said also, and we just need to talk with other people, try to move in a positive direction. I think that ultimately it has to lead to better things. As your colleagues are saying, it's probably not going to happen overnight, and we shouldn't expect it to do so. But I'm pleased that we're trying, and you know, the point that we do business with other countries whose behavioral records aren't any better than Cuba's these days, and possibly worse, just says to me, again, well, we should be communicating with Cuba. We should be trading with Cuba.
Warren, we got it from Delray Beach. Warren there voicing his support for reengagement with Cuba. And he mentioned the opposition that's been voiced by Florida's junior senator, Marco Rubio. And, of course, Rubio was in the headlines in the news this week for something a little different, announcing his presidential bid from the Freedom Tower in Miami. That's still to come on the Florida Roundup when we continue. But first, celebrating poetry this month with an ode to your zip code. We call it Zip Odes, and this one coming to us from Gretchen Schmidt in Coral Gables.
Lejeune, buildings, parks, so many Mediterranean details to scrutinize, ponder. This traffic ain't moving. 33134.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Marco Rubio officially now is in the 2016 race for the Republican presidential nomination. He announced his bid for the White House this week at the Freedom Tower in downtown Miami.
We must change the decisions we are making by changing the people who are making them. And so, that is why tonight, grounded by the lessons of our history, but inspired by the promise of our future, I announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
Rubio joins two of his fellow U.S. senators in the GOP race, Ted Cruz from Texas and Kentucky's Rand Paul. Do you support Senator Rubio for president? Will you donate money to his campaign? Have you already donated money or time to that campaign? And what do you make of his call for a new American century? Here on the Florida Roundup, you can reach us at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, online at WLRN.org, on Facebook and on Twitter at WLRN. Calvin Hughes, an anchor with Local 10, still with us here. David Adams, Southeast Bureau Chief with Reuters. And we're joined by Mark Caputo, Florida politics editor at Politico. Mark, let's begin here. Rubio spoke about what he calls this new American century with a capital C. What does he mean by that?
Well, I'd have to side with his critics here, saying that he's offering a lot of old wine and new skin here. There's a, you know, he's presenting pretty classic conservatism in his platform.
That's the criticism here. The New York Times editorial board described it as the retrofuturism of Marco Rubio.
Right. What Rubio's good at, and don't get me wrong, this is not unique to the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is the same thing. Right. And let's go back to Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. So starting with the Bible as our framework and politics, we do have to see that what Marco Rubio excels at is being a fantastic messenger. A very good messenger for his party. In many respects, his party's Obama. Now, of course, Obama lovers will consider that an apostasy, yes. A heresy, and Rubio lovers will also consider that, yes. Similarly. But the similarities are there.
Yes, yes. Equality in making enemies here today already with Marco Caputo. Calvin Hughes, what kind of themes, though, did we hear from the senator that we expect to hear early in the campaign trail?
Well, I think what's most interesting from one of the themes that he talked about is he said, essentially, don't tell me what to do, to the old part of the Republican Party. He said, you know, look, I mean, I am going to run. Some people told me to wait my turn. I am not going to wait my turn. And I think, obviously, that was to the older folks in the party saying, hey, you know, this is my time. I know Jeb is my mentor, but, you know, I am running right now. But I think we heard a lot of the old stuff. You know, one thing we heard about was peeling Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many times have we heard about that? We heard about, you know, pro-life, Roe v. Wade, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously. So many of the things that he has obviously made a cornerstone of his senatorial short tenure so far, I think we're going to see an extension of that over the campaign trail.
David Adams, though, and a question to you, too, is Mark, I mean, how is this candidacy, though, playing outside of South Florida? Marco Rubio, a relatively known political character here in South Florida, but what about outside of Florida, how this candidacy is greeted?
Well, I think Mark is right. He has a bigger persona outside of South Florida, folks who don't know him quite mm-hmm. as well as people do here. It's worth noting that Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, Lincoln Diaz-Balart, Mario Diaz-Balart, I'm not sure we know about Carlos Curbelo yet, the local Republican Cuban-American congressional delegation is not supporting Marco Rubio. There's too much legacy with Jeb Bush. And Jeb's supporters, frankly, were surprised that Marco Rubio adopted the line he did, talking about the new future and mm-hmm. him representing that, mm-hmm. Because they all point out that he really has represented traditional values all along, as Mark pointed out. But and that, funnily enough, Obama did actually come out with some new ideas in 2008. Obviously, Jeb Bush's supporters didn't like any of them, but they recognized that they were new ideas.
And
Marco's ideas, I mean, it's hard to see what is new about what he's proposing.
Well, the one different thing in his tax plan is that he's offering certain more middle-class tax cuts through the tax code, and Rubio was attacked or criticized in the Wall Street Journal editorial page for that very thing, using the tax code for social engineering and social policy. In this case, a social policy that wasn't solely trickle down. So you could say that might be something new for a very conservative candidate. As you both brought up, it was a great line. We said that people say I should wait my turn and I won't. It's like, how stupid are these people who are telling him this?
Yeah.
In 2010, he runs for Senate with no shot at all winning, no name ID, no money against a popular incumbent governor. And then he proceeds to just beat the pants off of him.
Yeah, yeah. And not only that, but have the governor leave his party.
Correct. He chased Charlie Crist out of the Republican Party.
Right.
Now, Jeb Bush is not Charlie Crist, but the reality is that if you cover conservatives and Republicans as long as I have and talk to as many as I have, Jeb does no longer speak conservative. And this is a problem for his candidacy. And Rubio does. Rubio speaks the language of conservative. A good example last night in New Hampshire, asked about Medicaid expansion, the fight in the legislature over it.
Right.
Jeb wasn't very clear about hell no on Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Today, Rubio got a question on an unrelated topic, and he circled back to hell no on Medicaid expansion. Mm. Like, he's speaking conservative, and Jeb isn't. And that could be a problem.
The Florida Roundup here, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. On Twitter, at WLRN is the handle. Leon joins the program from Hollywood. Go ahead, Leon. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for taking my call. My question is actually with regard to one of your guests mentioned that Marco Rubio, as a candidate, I think is actually a very good messenger. He delivers a very concise and understandable message. But somebody like myself, who's 26 years old, grew up in South Florida, has certain conservative leanings, I feel that he's trying to placate too strongly to the hardcore right-wing conservative base and won't attract a more representative sample of what my generation is looking for, which is somebody with financial conservative credentials, but essentially socially libertarian. I want to know what your panel thinks about Marco Rubio's appeal to a younger generation of conservatives.
Great question, Leon. Calvin, you want to tackle that first?
Well, I was first going to actually mention it right after Mark's comment, is that, I mean, he's 43. I mean, so he really tried to separate himself, you know, using words obviously like new and, you know, new American century. Those kinds of things, I think, will separate him from other Republicans who are in the field seeking the nomination. There's no doubt that he knows the importance of young people and how they played a significant role in getting Obama elected in his first and second term. So I think there's no doubt that, you know, Rubio understands that. I had a chance to travel with Rubio to Haiti on his very first trip. In fact, the only reporter to do that with him, found him to be very sharp, and as you talked about, Mark, being a very good messenger. And his wife, too, was on that trip as well. Her major issue is human trafficking, and she really wants to tackle that. And if she were to become the First Lady of the United States, that would be her main issue.
You know, one of the challenges he has early, as any candidate has early, you've got to appeal to Iowa Republicans, Senator Rubio does, and New Hampshire Republicans, which, being a native Iowan myself.
I was about to say something offensive about Iowa.
Please, I'll be the first in line, by the way, to say something. It's a great place to be from. Let me put it that way. Okay. That said, you know, that's a different political animal there than it is here.
Well, very much so. It's one of the damaging things for the Republican Party as far as its demographic troubles it's having, that is, it's the party of white people, is that, and I say this as a white person, is that not that it means I'm Republican, is that, you know, you wind up, and it's overwhelmingly evangelical, you wind up having to campaign to a demographic that's very different.
Right.
To the caller's question, you know, Rubio right now needs to focus on this. He needs to focus on bread and butter conservatism and all that stuff. And what he's also doing is at the same time, to Calvin's point, is he's layering in these symbolic poll-tested buzzwords. And over time, I think that message will come out. I thought he had a very impressive interview on NPR with Steve Inskeep, where he did probably the best job of any conservative defending these religious freedom laws, so-called.
Yeah, and before we get to that interview, you talk about kind of layering in some of these more moderate-type positions for crowd.
I don't think it's positions. I think it's his tone.
The tone. Okay, the tone. But to that tone gets to the character of Senator Rubio, which gets to the narrative that is the Rubio story. Parents born in Cuba coming to the United States in the 1950s, mom working as a retail clerk, dad as a bartender.
I'm humbled by the realization that America doesn't owe me anything. But I have a debt to America I must try to repay. This isn't just the country where I was born. America is literally the place that changed my family's history.
David Adams with Reuters, how does this story play into his politics, particularly immigration, and particularly into the center, the geographic center of the country, which is where the early part of the GOP nomination is really fought?
Well, it worked very, very well. It's worked very, very well for him so far. It was this is not a new message. He's been touting this line for a long time. It was very effective in 2010. And it's been quite effective also. I've seen him give this speech at Jeb Bush's Hispanic Leadership Network. So, you know, it is a message that resonates with Hispanics. Does it resonate with Hispanics outside of South Florida? That's a big question, which we haven't seen tested yet.
Yeah, we haven't. Let's go back to the phones here. Lourdes in Miami is joining the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Lourdes. Nice to hear from you.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You know, your initial question to get on the air was, you know, would you support Marco Rubio? And I'm a Cuban-American. I was born here. And I just have two issues with Marco Rubio. One is his stance on Medicaid. I remember when he was running for the Senate, he had a commercial where he praised Medicaid and thanked, you know, his dad was able to die with dignity in the hospital and in hospice because his dad was fortunate enough to have Medicaid. And then now all of a sudden...
Lourdes, I don't mean to interrupt you, but it was Medicare...
Medicare.
I'm sorry. Right,
and
okay.
And then now all of a sudden on Medicare, he, you know, wants to privatize it and, you know, take it out of the so-called, you know, umbrella of the government. And I think that would be a huge mistake. And on another note, you know, he says that the American dream is coming to this country and being able, you know, to have your kids go to college, earning, you know, minimum wage jobs. But that was in the 60s. you know, certainly minimum wage is not what it was in the 60s. And his stance on minimum wage is he does not want to raise minimum wage. So to me, that's kind of a hypocrisy where he's pointing out that he was able, you know, his parents were able to come to this country and have minimum wage jobs and support the family and have him go to college and so on and so forth. But that was during the 60s. That is not what it is today with the cost of living. And his voting is against the raise of minimum wage.
Lourdes,
I just don't get that.
Lourdes, we appreciate the input here. We're going to get to another call. Thanks for your thoughts there. Jose from Boca Raton joining the Florida Roundup. Jose, go ahead. Welcome.
Yes, hi, thank you. I first want to comment 91.3 for this nice debate. I support Marco Rubio. I think the young man has the philosophical principles that he is ignorable on Marxism, Leninism, and other things that are happening in the world, that American people are going to start listening to Marco Rubio very soon. I was listening to the debate of regarding events that happened in Panama, and I really am wondering who the communist regime, the communist regime recognizes as a legitimate opposition group or individual. So they were bullying in Panama all the Cubans who represent the society, the civil society, and they were doing whatever they wanted. So basically, how come the communist regime in Cuba doesn't recognize anyone that thinks in a different manner? After 2 million Cubans left the island, so many died on the Strait of Florida, etc., etc. Marco Rubio is going to address all these issues that are important for Cubans, for Americans, and the world. Thank you so much.
Jose from Boca Raton, thank you for your thoughts. Cuba has become and obviously is an issue for Senator Rubio here in South Florida. Before the speech at the Freedom Tower this week, Senator Rubio sat down with NPR's Steve Inskeep, who asked him about his stance on President Obama's efforts to restore relations with Cuba.
If you're elected, would you reverse that policy?
Absolutely. And I think the reason why is because I'm interested in, my interest in Cuba is freedom and democracy. I think the Cuban people, if they are free, have the right to choose any economic model they want to follow. I don't believe these changes will actually further democracy. In fact, I think they will make it harder to achieve.
Is Cuba a national campaign issue, Mark Caputo?
It sounds like it's becoming one.
Yeah.
And this is a very tricky issue because, you know, there are obviously, there's a lot of emotion over the embargo. There's a lot of polling over the embargo, though. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, the polling essentially favors Obama's position more than Rubio's or Jeb Bush's position on
certainly
this.
On a national scale. But even in South Florida, younger Cuban Americans.
The general breakdown is that if you're of Cuban descent and you came to this country after 1980, or are, you know, under 62, and are not a Republican, you're generally going to be in favor of what Obama's done.
Right.
And this feeds into what we were talking about earlier, is that a lot of Rubio's positions, while he's saying I stand for new things, is he does generally have a very hawkish Cold War policy as it regards Cuba. He's against medical marijuana. He opposes same-sex unions, and on down the line. So this is going to be one of these challenges he's going
to
face.
But is it fair to say that the Cuba issue opens the door to talk about other foreign policy decisions made by Obama? So
I think
that's why the Cuba issue becomes a national issue for Rubio.
Yeah.
But it opens the door for him to say, if he can make bad choices about Cuba, then here's what I can do differently with Iran and so on and so forth, Syria.
Calvin Hughes with Local 10, Mark Caputo with Politico, and David Adams with Reuters. We got plenty more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Disagreements in Tallahassee over Medicaid expansion, leaving Florida's budget in limbo with just days to go in the session. But first, another ode to your zip code from WLRN's own Nancy Klingener in Key West.
There is always just the one. Mosquito in the bathroom. 33040.
Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. Florida lawmakers have been in session now in Tallahassee for 45 days, three quarters of the way through, right? Well, they've passed 22 bills. None, though, is the singular bill that they go to Tallahassee that they have to pass, a state budget. The budget has not budged thanks to a fight between Republicans themselves over health care spending, as well as a legal fight brewing between Governor Rick Scott and the federal government.
Derek Hamm is a senior writer with News Service of Florida. Kathleen McGrory with the Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times with us from WFSU in Tallahassee, joining Calvin Hughes with Local 10 and Mark Caputo here with Politico in South Florida. Kat, are lawmakers working over the weekend, first of all?
No, they're not. Most of them have gone home, and frankly, there's really nothing on the calendar today. Or even on Monday, the House doesn't come back until Tuesday.
So 15 days in the session left here. Dara, what are the options?
Well, there are a couple of options, and none of them seem to be ones that the leaders want to take. Senator Lee, the Senate Budget Chief, told me the other day that he thought that one solution would be for nobody to get what they want, for Governor Scott not to get the $650+ million in tax cuts he's asking for the Senate president not to get the expansion of Medicaid that he's asking for, and for them to pass a budget but put the, you know, couple of billion dollars in reserves and wait and see what the federal government does regarding this LIP expansion, the low income renewal.
Yeah,
right,
it's the low income pool. It's this federal money that comes to the state and then gets doled out to hospitals to take charity cases, essentially, Mark Caputo, the uninsured Floridians. That money has been expiring. It'll run out in June under the current funding mechanism.
Correct. The low-income pool was negotiated by Jeb Bush, actually, in 2005 as part of Medicaid reform. And it's done to give hospitals a little extra bit of a safety net because they don't get fully reimbursed from Medicaid. Now, what we're seeing here is the federal government, in part, is doing a power play, and in part, the Republicans in the Florida legislature doing a power play. They refuse to expand Medicaid on the Florida side, and the feds are saying, you know what, if you don't do Medicaid expansion, you know, this low-income pool money, maybe you shouldn't have
it. Go away. And that linkage is where Governor Scott has come in and essentially said he's going to sue the federal government over this, saying that is in violation of the United States Supreme Court ruling, saying that the federal government cannot coerce states into expanding Medicaid.
But it's weird. I mean, he's essentially suing the federal government to give him money because wants to give him money for another program.
For something they haven't done yet,
It's a little tough.
And it's the House. Just to be clear, it's the Florida House that's dug in on not expanding Medicaid, and they're aligned with the governor who, let's remember, at one point, you know, gave tepid support for an expansion of Medicaid and now has, since he's won election, has changed his mind about that.
He's gone flip-flop-flip on Medicaid reform.
Flip-flop-flip.
Yeah, I thought he was for it, and now he's against it.
Yeah, right.
I'm telling everybody that this whole situation is giving me a giant lip sore. I know.
Calvin,
not just me.
Yeah.
You might have to get that treated.
Calvin Hughes, Caputo describes it as a little weird. Some would go beyond that here, because all this is happening with Republicans holding a majority in Tallahassee.
Yeah, once again, and Democrats understand they are like a locomotive. You either get on it or get run over by it, and that's exactly what they've been getting over the last several years, no doubt about
it. But what's really weird about this is that there's a real Alice in Wonderland quality here. Pardon the pun for saying Mad Hatter's Tea Party, but you have Rick Scott has been talking to the federal government over an incredibly complex thing.
Yes.
This hospital funding stuff. I mean, this is not easy stuff. You need an abacus and, you know, computer to figure this out. And they have nothing on paper. Yeah. And then earlier in the session, I was talking to these various politicians saying, well, what is your plan for the low-income pool? They're like, well, we don't quite know. I'm like, what do the federal government want? They said, well, we don't know. I said, you know what happens in my job? If my editor assigns me a story to write, and I write it, and I give the editor, and they said, no, that's not what we want. I say, well, what do you want?
Right.
And no one's had that conversation.
Well, and to the point that some of the Democrats in Tallahassee have made to the Republicans is, this has been coming. You've known this has been coming for the better part of several years. This is part of the Affordable Care Act that they wanted to wind down the low-income pool. They wanted states to expand. Medicaid. This tension is not manufactured at all.
Darryl,
right, and it's pretty clear. I mean, you think of it from the federal government's point of view. They've got a pot of money that the whole LIP program goes to pay for unreimbursed care. The whole notion of the Affordable Care Act is to get more people covered with insurance so that you reduce the amount of unreimbursed care. So if you expand Medicaid or you do whatever the Senate plan is, which is it's a fancy way of not saying that they are really expanding Medicaid, but their plan would pay for premiums for people who now are not insured, you reduce the amount of money that you would need to spend to cover people who can't pay their hospital bills. So, I mean, you can understand where the federal government is coming from when they're saying you have an there's a way for you to get these people to have their care covered. Why should we be spending these gazillions of dollars on picking up the tab for unreimbursed care when you can do something about it?
Let's put a definition to those gazillions of dollars here, Kat, because when you talk about the financial stakes here, the low-income pool is just over $2 billion at stake. Florida has a $1 billion surplus. I don't need an abacus for this, Caputo, but that leaves about a $1 billion hole if the LIP money goes away and Florida winds up having to pay the same general rate for the charity right. care. Is that about right, Kat?
Well, it's a $2.2 billion program, and the way that the hospitals, the way that Florida gets that money is some of the hospitals put money up, they send it up to the feds, and then the feds match it and send it back. So of that total $2.2 billion, $1.3 billion is federal dollars. So that's the piece
which soaks
that would
up the
account
the,
for
soaks
the
up the surplus
hole.
That we had when we began this whole dance in April.
Right, and in the end...
It very well could.
Yeah, and in the end, what you're seeing here as well is the state government, the legislators in the House and the governor, they don't want to spend the money on Medicaid and stuff like that. They want to spend it on tax cuts. I mean,
exactly.
That is a spending through the tax code, mm-hmm, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so the governor's probably not going to get what he wants, and the Senate's probably not going to get what it wants.
Calvin, we're going to be talking about this for weeks, aren't we?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. You go ahead and catch your breath there. He's down the wrong pipe for
Calvin's
for,
been
for
drinking Calvin. in the radio studio.
That's what happens, absolutely. But Kat and Dara, from your perspective here, it sounds like, you know, odds are almost 100% of a special session. But what about the odds of an actual budget before June 30th?
Well, I don't think they will let the government shut down if they, you know, it wouldn't shut down at, you know, 12:01 on July 1st. The fiscal year begins on July 1st.
Right.
So with all of the criticism that they've given to Washington about the, you know, impending federal government shutdowns, I doubt that they would allow that to happen in Florida. So my prediction is that they're going to come up with some sort of a solution that nobody's probably happy with, and they'll do it before June 30th.
We've got two of the best with us from Tallahassee, Kathleen McGrory with the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times, Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida, joining us courtesy of WFSU in Tallahassee. Calvin Hughes with Local 10, catching his breath again.
Thank you. Great to have you here for the full hour.
Yeah. And Mark Caputo with Politico joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Now, all this month, we've been asking you for your ode, your zip code, and boy, have you delivered in a big, big way. It's part of the Poetry Festival, Oh Miami, a five-line poem about where you live. Celebrating the rough edges from Palm Beach County to the Keys.
My name is Alessandra and I live in Miami Springs. Why is everyone here stuck in 2008? And why won't the dog park mafia let me into their clique? 33166.
My name is Lois Ann Davis and I live in Tequesta. Just before sunset in the summer, you can feel bites from 100 no-see-ums. And actually, you really can. See 'em, I mean. 33469.
My name is Judith Friedman, and I live in Boca Raton. Opening morning blinds onto the lanai, I am again delighted by tropical foliage, lake, birds, sky, sunshine, quiet, warmth. Retired in Boca, a happy cliche. 33496.
Bringing poetry to paradise here in South Florida. Submit your own zip ode on our website, WLRN.org. Follow all the directions that are there. You can send us via a tweet as well. Use the handle @WLRN and be sure to put the hashtag on the end, zip odes. Again, zip odes here at WLRN. Poetry in paradise. Finally, on the roundup, the sounds of South Florida this week with John O'Connor.
It's Friday. And this is what South Florida sounded like this week.
How would you change Ocean Drive? We all know we have a problem there. We all know there's a cancer there.
We have been enemies. We are still enemies.
You know, I didn't know if we were going to be greeted by guys with AK-47s, and honestly, they didn't even ask to see my passport.
Climate change, climate change, climate change. There, I've said it three times. There is absolutely no policy against discussing climate change.
So I saw this class taught by Marco Rubio, and I just decided, yeah, why not?
It is quite literally the sunshine economy sustaining the tropical sub-economy of Cuba.
If you go to Cuba, you will see that we have many, many spaces to have dialogues.
Reach the end of the line, so then you know.
To hear more, go to WLRN.org/thisweek.
The sounds of South Florida here on the Florida Roundup. That'll do it for this program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. It's produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Julia Duba, and Steph Farrow. Our executive producer is Peter J. Meritz. Technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell is next Monday morning at 9. It's the healthcare gap in the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend.